Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Worthy v. College.
Thank you, Court.
The issue in this case is the extent, if any, of preemption of state damage suits by the medical device amendments of 1976 to the Food and Drug Act. Before getting into the merits of my argument, I'd like to call the court's attention to three new cases. The cases seem to come down on a monthly basis on this issue. I'm not going to read the cites to them. They're included in a letter that the court should have gotten by Federal Express as we were speaking. It was shipped out yesterday.
Why don't you tell us what the cases are?
Okay, well, I don't have
Well, never mind.
Cites.
Maybe they'll come up during the course of your argument.
They are three Intermediate Court of Appeals cases, one from Illinois, one from California, one from Michigan. They all involve Class 3 medical devices that had been through the PMA approval process. All three courts are unanimous and hold in construing the Medtronix case to mean there is no preemption of any state cause of action that was asserted in those cases, and every action you can imagine was asserted in one of those cases or the other.
So do you conclude that essentially you can't state a common law cause of action that's preempted by the amendment?
I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. I'm sure we can imagine a cause of action that could be stated that would make it impossible for the manufacturer to comply both with a specific FDA requirement and a specific requirement that would be created by the cause of action.
Well, like what, for example?
The example given by the concurring justice in the Medtronix case, where he was hypothetically stating a situation where the FDA specifically and explicitly required a 2-inch wire, and the cause of action resulted in a requirement of a 1-inch wire.
Was Justice Breyer suggesting that you have to look at not past just the pleadings and what the evidence was at trial to see whether there were competing, differing requirements?
I think that would be the result of Justice Breyer's analysis, Your Honor. You have to basically have a trial and see what facts develop in the course of the trial before Justice Breyer would be able to express an opinion on whether there was preemption.
For our purposes, are you saying that we can decide that at the pleading stage, as courts seem to be doing, or that it has to go to...
No, Your Honor, I'm wanting you to remand it for a trial for that reason, among others, but I'm hoping for more guidance than just we have to have a trial and we'll decide later.
Your suit is a DTPA claim.
Well, the suit was both a DTPA claim and other claims, but the Court of Appeals didn't decide to rule on the others, which is a complaint that you have not expressed an interest in hearing argument on today.
But if it goes down to trial, if only DTPA were tried, and the principal complaint is, for lack of a better term, just a breach of implied warranty that this product unsafe, then you might have preemption. Whereas if it's more in a particular laundry list, rifle shot problem, it may not be preempted, at least if Justice Breyer's view is controlled.
Well, Justice Breyer's opinion, as I read it, he construes the statute as basically enacting or coming close to enacting the court-made rules of when there is implied preemption, that being where it's impossible for one to comply both with federal law and a state law, or where a federal law has completely occupied a field where there is an exclusion of state law. Now, the courts have repeatedly held that occupation of the field is not an issue here because health and safety is a matter of preeminent state and local concern rather than federal concern. So Justice Breyer, as his hypothetical indicates, would only find preemption if there was an actual impossibility to comply with a state and a federal requirement. But getting on to the merits of what five justices agreed to in the Medtronix case, there is one thing that they clearly agreed to. It's stated in Section 5, which five justices endorsed of the opinion, and in Justice Breyer's concurring opinion. They all, five of them, agreed that the FDA is, the term they use was uniquely qualified to determine the extent of preemption under the statute, because the FDA is dealing with the regulation of the manufacturers, and they are in the best position to determine whether activities by state or local governments or state or local courts conflict with their regulation of the industry. The Court of Appeals in this case acknowledges that any fair reading of the FDA regulations applicable to this case, that there is no preemption according to the FDA. The FDA regulations, the FDA's interpretation of the statute, and I'm quoting here from 21 CFR 808.1, states that the statute, quote, does not preempt state and local requirements of general applicability where the purpose of these requirements relates to products other than devices. Now, clearly, state product liability law, the DTPA, the common law causes of action that we're dealing with in this case are laws of general applicability.
But if that were the only element, if that were the controlling element, then the 2-inch, 1-inch wire example would not be preempted in a DTPA case.
Unless the court interprets it to apply to a specific device, according to Justice Breyer.
Which it doesn't. The DTPA applies to all sorts of products.
Right, it does.
So how can he be using the 2-inch, 1-inch wire example and then saying, but if it's a law of general application like the DTPA, then it's not preempted?
Well, he's saying that it's usually not preempted, and you have to look at the specific facts. You have to have a trial, as Justice Corin suggests, and look at the specific facts to determine whether the result of the case is a requirement that actually and positively conflicts with a specific federal requirement.
So to use his example, if it was a 2-inch, 1-inch trough.
Yes.
But it was under the DTPA, and when you got done with the trial, even though the DTPA is a statute of general applicability, the action would have been preempted.
That's what Justice Breyer, I believe, is saying, yes. Now, whether his opinion is necessarily controlling, the plurality puts in what he terms dicta that's much broader than that, and he also adopts Section 5, which I'm going to get to in a minute.
But a trial under broad form submission may not help us much anyway. Even if we can figure out where this line is, there may be lots of different theories and lots of different evidence, and we won't know what was dispositive or not.
If there's lots of different theories and some of the theories that are supported by evidence are not preempted, then I would say no preemption. And I think Justice Breyer would say no preemption. That's why the plurality says it's very unlikely that there's going to be preemption of a common law cause of action. Getting back to what the FDA regulations say, they list examples of things that, in the opinion of the FDA, are not preempted by the statute. And two of their examples are very significant to this case. One is UCC warranties. Now, in Texas, product liability cases can be brought either under common law or under the UCC. But how one would draw a distinction between a common law product liability case and a UCC warranty product liability case for purposes of preemption is beyond me. So it would seem that the FDA in its very regs is saying this case is not preempted. The other example it lists of a law of general applicability that would not be preempted by the statute is unfair trade practices. Well, that's awfully, awfully close to our Deceptive Trade Practices Act when they're saying, the FDA is saying, the statute doesn't preempt unfair trade practices statutes of general applicability. In addition, in the record attached to our response to the motion for summary judgment is an opinion letter from the FDA specifically addressing whether the statute preempts product liability cases. And the opinion of the FDA counsel who wrote the letter is no, it does not preempt product liability cases.
If though the FDA's good manufacturing practice regulations, as the dissenting justices say, imposes comprehensive requirements relating to every aspect of the device manufacturing process, including a manufacturer's organization and personnel, buildings, equipment, component controls, production and process controls, packaging and labeling controls, holding, distribution, installation, and device evaluation and record keeping, how can the state law allow a manufacturing defect claim involving that product without imposing requirements that are different from or in addition to the federal requirements?
Okay, the requirements that are in addition to are greater than the federal requirements have to be requirements with respect to a device. That's in the statute, that's the key words of the statute, and that's where the Court of Appeals got this all wrong.
The logical gap is that every lawsuit involves a particular device, does it not? And why isn't that any more intrusive into the federal domain than a specific regulation that says we're going to have additional or different requirements for the manufacturing process? How is that any different in effect?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but the majority of five of the Supreme Court, and this is a very important, the last paragraph of Section 5 of the Medtronix opinion, in my opinion, is the most important paragraph in the opinion. There, the Supreme Court writes, the legal duty that is the predicate for the lawyer's negligent manufacturing claim is the general duty of every manufacturer to avoid foreseeable dangers in its products. Similarly, the predicate for the failure to warn claim is a general duty to inform users and purchasers of potentially dangerous items. These state requirements therefore escape preemption because their generality leaves them outside the category of requirements that 360K envisioned as being requirements, quote, with respect to a particular device. You have to, which the Court of Appeals, in my opinion, did not read the entire statute, and every word in it is of significance, and these words, with respect to a device, according to the FDA, according to the Supreme Court, require that the state requirement you're dealing with specifically impact on that particular device and not be a general law, such as a product liability or a DTPA law.
But how do you square that with Justice Breyer's two-inch, one-inch case? You're suing for product liability, and you're saying it should have been one-inch, not two. But a product's liability is a general law, and when assume it's just that simple, doesn't he see an exception to this language in Part 5?
Now, I believe he sees an exception under very narrow circumstances, under a very particular fact situation, which he describes.
Do you agree with that fact situation?
The fact situation he describes is a specific federal regulation requiring a two-inch wire, I believe it's in a hearing aid, and a state lawsuit apparently where the only evidence of the defect of the hearing aid was that it was defective because it did not have a one-inch wire, as opposed to a 2-inch wire.
Well, what if the evidence in this case, if you go to trial, is, comes down to there's one thing wrong with this, with the collar, with the product, and it is one of the things that was in this very extensive review that found to be necessary and safe for this product by the USDA?
It's important not to confuse the review with a requirement. The FDA did not require any particular design. They merely said, you may sell a product that complies with our review. There's a difference, a big gulf between that and the hypothetical Justice Breyer is giving, where the FDA explicitly required a 2-inch wire. There's nothing explicit here that collagen is explicitly required to have any 2-inch wire or anything particular in the product.
The Supreme Court, in its factual recitation and a little bit thereafter, the plurality opinion, is at great pains to distinguish between the 360 review and the 510 review. But I suppose under your reading, that's all just purely dicta, because you would say that paragraph 5 applied equally to whatever type of review the FDA undertakes.
I assume you're referring to Section 5 of the opinion.
Yeah, I meant Section 5.
And yes, they're describing the fact scenario to decide the case before them, and it's not dicta in that sense, but I don't think attaching legal significance to their description of the fact scenario is.
But they go to great pains to say that 360 is not the same as 510, and they mention 360 then throughout the opinion, but the rationale you've given us really makes no distinction between whether it's a cursory review or the full court press.
That is true, and I have at least three courts that I ship you the opinions that are agreeing with me, finally.
Well, we need to, in your opinion, to look at these circuit cases to help flesh out the rationale.
They're not circuit cases, they're intermediate court of appeals.
They're intermediate state courts of appeals?
Right, Your Honor.
Have any circuits spoken on Medtronic since?
Since the Medtronic's opinion, the only circuit that has spoken is the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit is the same circuit that issued the Kennedy opinion that said there's no preemption, no how, no way, no time under the statute, and they basically followed their Kennedy opinion after Medtronic and said there was still no preemption at no time.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
The court, Mr. Joe Redden, will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, before the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the lower decision last June, the issues being addressed by this court had been looked at by 10 of the 12 circuit courts of appeals. And with one exception, that being the Ninth Circuit, every court that looked at this issue agreed that common law tort actions are subject to preemption by the federal medical device amendments.
But those really are, that's not very helpful. That's not as helpful to us now as looking at any one sentence on Medtronic trumps the circuit history before this.
The issue, obviously, is to what extent the lower versus Medtronic opinion affects these other cases. Are they still good law or not? And I would submit to the court that when you look at Lohr against Medtronic, or this issue in general, there are really two issues, because the statute talks about state requirements that are subject to preemption, and it talks about federal requirements that can do the preemption. So you've got to look at those separately. The first issue is, are common law tort actions the types of requirements that can be preempted by this statute? And the Supreme Court has now told us in Lohr that they are, because five justices voted that way. The four dissenters clearly said that they were in the O'Connor opinion, and Justice Breyer said that they are very clearly.
If that's true, then how do you explain the denial of cert in the Kennedy case and the vacation of the judgment in the Mitchell case and remand for reconsideration in light of Medtronic? Because Kennedy of the Ninth Circuit said the state common law does not relate solely to or regulate any particular device or product to the exclusion of other devices or products, and is common law claims therefore general and are not preempted?
I really can't explain that, Justice Warren. I don't understand that, except to point out to you that Kennedy, one of the basic holdings of Kennedy was that common law tort actions just are not subject to preemption by this statute. And yet we know that five justices on the Supreme Court have now held to the contrary, which seems to me just cuts the legs out from under Kennedy. So I would suggest that Kennedy is not accurate to that extent. I don't understand.
But they handed that down the same day they decided Medtronic, right?
They did. Very, very close thereafter. And to answer one of Justice Phillips' questions, these other cases are working their way back through. In fact, Mitchell versus Collagen out of the Seventh Circuit, I just argued that last week. So it's been rebriefed, it's been re-argued. I understand some of the other cases are going through the federal circuits, but there have been no federal circuit court decisions yet that have come down after Medtronic.
One of the points up here is that the common law cause of action are not for us, just the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, which is an act of general applicability, applies to the sales transaction across the board.
Sure.
As I understand the federal regulations from the FDA, there is requirements for warning on these devices, but a manufacturer is not bound by those warnings if they find additional contraindications or something that would make the product more safe.
Well,
so do you agree that's what the regulations say?
Not exactly. I think what you're referring to, if you look at the approval order for the collagen device, it does provide that, first of all, it says before making any change that may affect safety or effectiveness, including warning, the manufacturer has to submit a supplemental PMA for review and approval by the agency.
Except where it enhances the safety, in which event they can do that and simply notify the FDA by letter.
Right, but the FDA then will look at that and determine whether or not that remains in effect. It still has to be approved by the agency. What this is sort of a common sense thing that says if you see something that urgently needs attention and it relates to safety, you can go ahead and make the change if you go through these procedural requirements submitted to the agency. You don't have to sit around and wait several weeks while the agency looks at it. That's the intent of this.
But the manufacturer is free to make certain changes in the product prior to approval by the FDA if it's an enhancement in the safety of the product.
On a temporary basis, that's correct.
So any allegation of a product that was not properly, didn't have the proper warnings on it, in a state circumstance where there's a judgment that says it should have had this additional warning, then what happens is the manufacturer isn't inconsistent with the FDA. They simply write a letter off the FDA advising that this is an enhancement to the product, and the FDA anticipates that those kind of changes will occur.
In theory, that could happen. But unless the FDA comes along and then approves that, that's not going to stay in effect. And also the statute says the manufacturer may do that, not the manufacturer shall or the manufacturer should.
So subsequently the FDA can come along and say, no, we don't want to make these improvements, and so the next product that comes along would not have those improvements.
That's true.
But the product that was manufactured at this point, that was enhancement, that product would be okay. All you do is write a letter to the FDA.
Well, it's a little more than just writing a letter, but if you comply with these requirements, that's true. At least during that temporary period, you would not be subject to being charged with misbranding the product.
Can you claim that that's an unequivocal statement by the Congress or this agency that they intend to preempt any laws of general applicability that were designed to enhance product safety?
Well, I think to get back to the point that Justice Heck raised, if you take this argument that they're making, that laws of general applicability are not preempted, and you look at that logically, what that's saying is common law tort actions are never preempted, because there is no common law tort action that's specific to a medical device. There's not one. The only laws, the common laws that apply to these devices are general laws of negligence, strict liability, fraud, etc.
Do you agree that paragraph What do you make of paragraph five, of the part five? What else in the paragraph?
I would say, Your Honor, that there is some, I'd say that there's some loose language in there that supports what he's saying. But that when you, that four
Why
justices...
Why isn't Breyer's other writing just loose, given that he joined in the entire judgment?
Because he's very specific, as Justice Heck pointed out in that hypothetical, that if you've got a federal requirement in place, and you've got a state requirement that's imposed by a statute or regulation, or through a common law negligent design lawsuit, there's no difference. That in either case, it's preempted. And also, Justice Breyer told us that in his view, unlike this plurality opinion, that the instances of common law preemption will be neither few nor rare.
Well, how can we know whether there's a conflict under Judge Breyer's opinion until the case is tried and the jury verdicts in?
Quite easy, actually, Your Honor, because under the PMA context, there are specific federal requirements relating to the design of this device, the manufacturing process, and the labeling of this device. And their causes of action here would impose different state law requirements. They're saying that you should have either designed it in a different way, different chemical composition, you should have manufactured it in a different way, you should have worn it in a different way. So it's very clear on the face of the out. We don't have to wait for a trial to figure that out. What they want to do is impose a different type of requirement under the guise of state law from what has already been imposed specifically through the PMA process.
Mr. Reddenell, let me, on that point, we're talking about this, and so I'm clear. I'm not sure of what may show up at trial, but the 1-inch, 2-inch wire. Are you saying that if the FDA looks at this device, and the device happens to be made with a 1-inch wire, and they say this device has proved to be sold, in the trial of the case, they demonstrate that a 1-inch device is more dangerous than a 2-inch wire device. Are you saying the mere fact that it happened to be in the device when the device was approved is a specific approval of the 1-inch wire?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Exactly what I'm saying. And I don't
now, is the example used in Breyer's opinion, could it be explained, could Breyer's opinion be explained by his view that he's not going to permit a simple, here's the schematic of this device, okay, it's approved, to be an unequivocal expression of preemption when in a later trial you find out that the 1-inch wire actually is defective, it should have been a 2-inch, and that makes the product safer.
Isn't that the way
to explain that?
No, I don't think you can explain it at all.
Okay.
His hypothetical is that the federal regulation says there has to be a 2-inch wire in all hearing aids. That's the regulation. And to come along then in a separate trial and have the plaintiff's expert testify that, well, I think a 1-inch wire is more appropriate, a 2-inch wire is dangerous, Justice Breyer says that's preemptive.
Right. Yeah. I agree this way, sir.
Okay, now, I would submit to the court that there's no difference conceptually between that example and the situation where collagen designs a hearing aid that has a two-inch wire, okay? They submit it to the FDA, and it goes through this exhaustive pre-market approval process, which in collagen's case for this device took over a year. Eventually, the FDA looks at that, and they decide to approve that hearing aid with a 2-inch device. And they issue an order saying you can manufacture and sell this product only as built, as designed in that way, with this 2-inch wire. If collagen goes out and they decide to change that design and sell one with a 1-inch wire, then they're subject to having every one of those devices confiscated and seized by the agency. They have violated the terms of their pre-market clearance, and they're in violation of federal law. That basically imposes the same requirement on that particular device, that specific device, by virtue of going through this pre-market approval process, as a hypothetical that Justice Breyer gives us, where the agency issues a regulation that applies to all hearing aid devices. In fact,
during the PMA process, can there be a back and forth between the agency and the manufacturer for certain changes to be made, and are those memorialized through some type of written?
Yes, there is. In fact, if you look at the record in this case, first of all, during the PMA process, you'll see correspondence is attached to some of the exhibits from the agency back to collagen saying, we need additional information, you have to do additional testing, et cetera, before the device is approved. And then As one of the conditions of approval, the manufacturer has to submit annual reports of any adverse reactions to the device.
But does, in this case, do the agency require the manufacturer to change anything in the design before they would approve it, as opposed to just asking for more information?
I'm not sure about whether they were required to change the design. I know they were required to do additional immunological testing.
Was it, were they required, in this case, were they required to change it? You don't remember?
I don't remember that, specifically.
Does that happen?
Yes.
Manufacturers are required to make changes?
Yes, the agency has a lot of authority. They don't just get the design and then say yes or no, up or down. In fact, it's submitted to a panel of experts in the field, which then gives advice to the agency. The agency's free to go back, tell the manufacturer that we're not going to approve it unless you do this and so. So there is a lot of back and forth in this process. It is an extensive and a very rigorous process. And as you noted earlier, Your Honor, the Supreme Court was careful to distinguish between the PMA process under 360 and the 510K process that was at issue in the Lohr case, because under the 510K process, all you have to do is show that the device is substantially equivalent to a grandfathered device that was being sold before 1976 when the MDA was enacted. There is no finding of safety and effectiveness under the 510K process, whereas under the PMA process, the FDA has to find that there's a reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness before it can statutorily approve the device. In the Supreme Court.
But in your mind, that meets the specific requirement, just a general approval that this device is approved?
It very definitely is a specific requirement, the PMA process, and it results in extensive specific requirements, Your Honor, because although the process does apply to more than just one device, what happens is when a device goes through that process, that particular device is studied and analyzed, and ultimately if it's approved, the agency submits an approval order with conditions under which that product can be marketed. For example, it cannot be designed in any other way, it cannot be manufactured pursuant to any other process.
Now where would we find those requirements?
Those are included in Appendix 12 to our tab 12 to our appendix has a copy of Collagen's the approval order that was issued by the FDA.
So your position, Mr. Redden, is once these collagen implants go through the PMA process, and there can be no state law suits for personal injuries based virtually any theory?
That is correct, John. That is correct.
And there's no court that's made such a holding since the Medtronic case, is there?
Not yet. Not in the PMA context. There is not.
Let me ask you just also while I'm thinking about it. Mr. Hamby also asked us to direct our attention to Section 808.1 of the Code of Federal Regulations, the FDA regulations, how would you respond to those provisions which say that unfair trade practices in which the requirements are not limited to devices are not preempted, at least in the FDA's opinion?
Well, the answer to that is that's really another shade or phase of this law's general applicability argument, because that's where that argument comes from, is that regulation, because it says that laws of general applicability such as the warranty of fitness are not preempted. The answer to that is that generally that's true. For example, the UCC is not preempted. If you want to buy or sell medical devices and there's a lawsuit for not paying the purchase price or that sort of thing, of course the UCC is not preempted. That's what that regulation is saying. But when you try to apply the generally applicable UCC law in a specific case in such a manner that you impose a state law requirement that is different from or in addition to the federal requirement that's applicable to this device through the PMA process, then you have preemption, which is what Justice Breyer is telling us in his opinion. So in theory, these laws of general applicability are not preempted, but if you try to apply them in the context of a device like this one, where there are specific requirements, then you have preemption. I think that's the way you reconcile that.
Is it fair to say that Regulation 808 and the FDA counsel's letter indicate that the FDA does not think an action like this is fair?
No, I really don't think it's fair, Your Honor. The FDA has not taken a position with respect to PMA devices. We don't really know what their position is. The letter that he's referring to, I think, was written about IUDs, and it involved something that was before the NDA even went into effect, and it just has nothing to do with this case. They've raised this countless times, and it just has nothing to do with it. Let me correct one statement I made earlier.
Once there's been approval, is the manufacturer required to keep the FDA informed of lawsuits?
There is an adverse reaction reporting requirement that's imposed both generally in the regulations and statutes and also in collagen-specific approval order, where they have to annually report various adverse reactions to the product.
Including lawsuits?
I don't know that it's specifically lawsuits, but they have to report adverse reactions and file specific called adverse reaction reporting forms that have to be filed with the FDA, whether or not there's a lawsuit. There may or may not be. But any reports like that have to be filed with the agency. So the agency continues to monitor this. They can revoke the PMA. They have all kinds of powers if they feel that there's a problem with the product. So it's not where you just approve it and that's the end of it. The agency continues to regulate and monitor these products. Justice Cornyn had asked me earlier about other cases, and this slipped my mind. I neglected to mention it, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, it's not a federal court, but I filed it with the court about a week ago, the Green case, where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, we do have that in the PMA context, in fact, involving this very product, where they found that virtually all causes of action were preempted in that case. So I would refer the court to that particular case.
So even if Regulation 808 expresses the intent of the statute, you don't think you lose?
No, I don't, Your Honor. That regulation has to be construed with a rule of reason as to what it means. There is some ambiguity in that regulation, clearly. And the Supreme Court specifically looked at that regulation as part of the Medtronic decision. Justice Breyer knew it was there. And yet the specific example he gives on the hearing aid, he says the law of negligent design would be preempted in that type of case.
But all nine judges stopped short of saying that it expressed the intent of the statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
All nine justices stopped short of saying that the regulation expressed the intent of the statute.
The dissenters did not believe that it did. The four dissenters would not have required a specific federal requirement. Even any generic general requirement would be enough for preemption in their view. The other five, the four, the Stevens opinion and the Breyer opinion, said, no, there's got to be a little more specificity than that. There's going to be preemption. But I think the important point here is that in this case, with the PMA process, we have that specificity. And I think the Supreme Court, faced with that question, would resolve it in that manner. I think it's perfectly consistent with what they did in Lohr. It's just very important to understand what they had before them in Lohr and what they didn't have before them in Lohr.
In the face of such substantial uncertainty about what the Supreme Court meant and what you're going to do with it, what's wrong with having a drug in this case and seeing the records and seeing if it ends up that the liability is attached by a federal jury against you for something that the federal government required you to do in order to get this device approved?
Well, I suppose
I'm not saying that's a good rule for 100 years, but why what is wrong right now as a solution to this case?
Well, I think from the standpoint of the litigant, having to go through extensive discovery and trial of an issue, well, it seems clear that as a legal point, particularly the DTPA action, we've got a state statute, it seems very clear that is preempted under these circumstances, and I would suggest that it's simply unfair. If we have a summary judgment practice, and if a litigant is entitled to judgment as a matter of law and form, in order to avoid expensive and lengthy trial, that should be done, and I guess that would be my answer to that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
To clarify the question before the last one, the answer to your question is that five of the nine justices specifically went with the FDA on the interpretation of the statute.
Okay. My point was they stopped short. I mean, the dissent says, well, you won't go the whole way and say this is the law, like you might do in some other context. Uh-huh. And Judge Breyer does seem to hedge around a little bit on it, but clearly he's persuaded that the regulation expresses the statute.
He's persuaded that this type of statute is one in which the court ought to defer to the opinion of the regulatory body charged with administering the statute, which is a general federal rule of interpreting statutes if they're at all ambiguous, which derives from the Chevron case, which is cited in the Medtronic's opinion, that unless the statute is crystal clear and the agency has given it a wrong interpretation, that the courts ought to defer to the opinion of the agency that's charged with administering the statute on what the meaning of the statute is. Okay, turning for a minute to their approval letter, I think counsel is reading more into it than is there. The letter says that they may market Zyderm collagen implant. The approval letter doesn't provide any precise definition or any wiring diagram of what constitutes a collagen, a Zyderm collagen implant. That's a vast difference from Judge Breyer's hypothetical, where the regulation explicitly and unequivocally required a 2-inch wire and none other. There's got to be some variation in what constitutes a Zyderm collagen implant to use the hypothetical. If the FDA issued a regulation saying you may market this hearing aid and the difference in the wire was not substantial, or increasing the length of the wire increased the effectiveness of the device, I think he's over-reading the approval order to say that you may only market exactly what was submitted to the FDA without any variation whatsoever. In fact, as was pointed out by Justice Enick, the appendix labeled conditions of approval to the approval order specifically permits collagen to make changes in labeling, manufacturing, sterilization, packaging, or performance of design specification which enhance the safety of the device without previously submitting those changes to the FDA. In fact, this approval order virtually tracks the language of the federal regulation, which I don't off the top of my head know the number of, to which Justice Enick was referring when he was asking the question. So there's a vast difference between saying you have to have a 2-inch wire and then having a state jury say no, your 2-inch wire was defective, it had to be a 1-inch wire, and having a general approval order, you may market this product, and without prior approval, you may make increases in safety to the product, and having a state jury come back and say, you should have made this increase because it would have made the product more safe, it wouldn't have caused a damage to the plaintiff. Further questions?
Anything further? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral arguments for today. All both cases will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right.